You know, the online world is great for so many things. It's great for making you laugh, it's great for entertainment, and every now and again you come across ideas or people that literally blow your mind. But I still think some of our best thinking happens offline. So join me, Nessa, on Offline Thoughts as I chat about some of the things I think about when I'm not online. I'm really glad you're listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this week's episode. If you might have noticed that I was missing last Monday, it's because I decided to take Easter Monday off. And whilst I was off, there was like major news where the UK Supreme Court ruled that the interpretation of sex, woman, and man, that those terms were going to be interpreted going forward as meaning specifically and exclusively biological sex. Now, the reason why that's super important and why it was a landmark ruling was that it has wide-reaching implications for trans people, access to single spaces, and more broadly, the rights of women. What I want to talk about in this episode then is specifically that. I spent a lot of time thinking about it over the last week and a half or so. For your benefit, I actually watched the rulings. So they actually have them online if you want to go and check it out. It's 9 hours of both sides basically presenting their case in front of the court. And after the 9 hours of hearings, there's a 20-minute adjudication where the judge goes through why the court decided or ruled the way that they did. So that's what I want to talk about in this episode. I want to talk about the ruling. I want to talk about the context in which the ruling took place. I want to talk about the organization or groups that brought this challenge to the UK Supreme Court, and also some of the stuff that sort of brought us to where we are today. And then in the final segment, I want to talk about some of the argumentation that we've heard from the trans movement and how that has intersected with what we heard in the hearings, and also just in general, like some of the stuff I've been reading from different publications based on the UK Supreme Court ruling. So with that introduction, let's go straight into it. So this court case actually has its origins all the way back in 2018, and it has its origins not in England, actually, but in Scotland. So as part of the Equalities Act of 2010, there is a general understanding that employers and public bodies can enact like certain like positive actions to guarantee that there's an equitable representation of certain underrepresented groups. And what that simply means is that if an employer looks around, for example, and they see that the majority of people who work there or who are applying for jobs or who are being hired are men, and that that is unrepresentative of the society that we live in, namely that there are 50% men and 50% women roughly in society. And so to a large extent, that should be visible in the workforce. So if the employer looks around and sees that that isn't the case, they basically have the right under the Equalities Act to take certain positive actions to bring about that reality, to bring about that ideal of there being like a 50-50% split. Because the understanding is that there's probably a negative reason why women either aren't being hired or aren't being promoted to positions of power. So anyway, going back to Scotland, the Scottish Parliament in 2018 passed this legislation called the Gender Representation on Public Boards Act of 2018. And what this act sought to do was initially to increase the representation of women on the public authorities' boards. So they were looking around, they were noticing that on public boards that it was basically like overwhelming majority of them were men. And so what they wanted was to have a quota whereby at least 50% of the board members would be women. So far, like, so good, like, really not controversial. The controversy comes in when Parliament, the Scottish Parliament, decide to include within the female quota, the 50% female quota, they decide to include trans women. And so what that in effect means is that 50% of the board will be men who identify as men. And then within the 50% quota allocated to women will be comprised of women, but also men who identify as women, i.e. trans women. Scotland comes in And in case you haven't seen or heard about them before, as frankly I hadn't either before this, they're a charity and an organization that's dedicated towards advancing the rights of women and children. So For Women Scotland see this Scottish Parliament proposal to include trans women or men who identify as women as part of the 50% quota. And they challenge this. They say, why, when women are incredibly underrepresented, when the whole point of including biological women on these boards was to bring their lived lives, their lived experiences into that role, into that position, and on top of that, to ensure like a higher representation of women in these organizations or on these bodies, why would you include men who identify as women, because they won't have the lived experiences of women? And also, like, that's not what the purpose of the positive action was. So you kind of created something that was specifically designated for women, to improve the conditions of women, to improve the representation of women, to include the views of women, to include the lived experiences of women. But then you've sort of given that, or given a section of that, to men or to women who identify as men. And this part is really, really important, because the Gender Recognition Act of 2004 was the second legislation in the UK that gave trans people the legal recognition of their changed sex. So the Gender Recognition Act basically allows for trans people to apply for a gender recognition certificate. And once they have the certificate, they are, under the law, the preferred sex. So for example, if you're a woman who identifies as a man, and through the Gender Recognition Act, you apply for a gender recognition certificate, and that is given to you, it means that you, under the law, you are legally recognized as a man, as male. And similarly, if you're a man who identifies as a woman, and through the Gender Recognition Act, you get a gender recognition certificate, it means that in the eyes of the law, and legally, and for all purposes, or nearly all purposes, you are legally a man. And this form of attaining the preferred sex, if you will, you know, in the hearing they refer to it as certificated sex. So you might have a biological sex, and then you would have, through this gender recognition certificate, a certificated sex. So this is what the Scottish Parliament leans on in response to the For Women Scotland group coming forward and saying, hang on a second, why are you including trans women in this? The Scottish Parliament says, well, actually, trans women are women legally under the law. And so because the Gender Recognition Act of 2004 recognizes them as women under the law, and it allows them to, for example, to change their passport to female, their driving license to female, it even allows them to change their birth certificate, it allows them to change their marriage certificate, it basically allows them to be, for all purposes, or for nearly all purposes, to be women. They basically said, given that they are legally women, like actually legally women, there's no reason why they wouldn't be included in this quota. Or put another way, it's completely legitimate and fair and right to include them in the quota. And in case you lost track of the quota I was talking about, this is the 2018 bill that they passed called the Gender Representation on Public Boards Act 2018. So the quota was designed to have 50% men and 50% women, mostly to increase the representation of women on these boards, which was lacking. Now, initially, when For Women Scotland applied to the Scottish courts to have this challenged, to have Parliament challenged on the inclusion of trans women in the 50% quota, they actually initially win. And the reason why they win is based on a technicality. And that technicality is that the Scottish Parliament has devolved powers. So they have authority to make certain decisions for Scotland as a country, but there are like a certain list of things or a certain list of matters that they're basically not allowed to legislate on. So they don't have like devolved powers for those certain matters. And I don't know what the list is, but I do know it includes making changes that would fundamentally change the Equalities Act of 2010. So the reason why the Scottish lower courts initially ruling in For Women Scotland's favor, i.e. saying, you know, we rule for you was because by including trans women in the quota, it basically was saying that the Scottish government or Scottish Parliament was changing the fundamental understanding of the Equalities Act, namely that they were changing the definition of woman to include also people of a different natal sex. So they were including basically biological men in the definition of woman under the Equalities Act, and that was a big deal basically. So after initially winning in the lower courts, the Scottish Parliament challenges this. They appeal the decision, and they point to the Gender Recognition Act of 2004, and they say, listen, actually these women, trans women, are legally women. And so because they are legally women, and because the 2010 Equalities Act was written after the 2004 Gender Recognition Act, it implies that the UK government or UK Parliament already knew that the Gender Recognition Act existed and already knew that there was such a thing as certificated sex, i.e. such a thing as people born in different sexes being able, through the Gender Recognition Act and through the process of getting a gender recognition certificate, able to legally change your sex. So given that they knew that that was the case, the fact that they didn't expressly say or explicitly say that sex or the definition of woman or man will not include individuals with a certificated sex or will not include transgender individuals must mean that implicitly they agreed that trans women would be included in sex, in women, in the definition of women, because they had a certificated sex that said that they were women under the law. And similarly, that trans men would be included under the definition of men in the Equalities Act because they had a certificated sex that said that they were legally men. So after going through the appeal process, the Scottish Parliament actually ends up winning on appeal. And so at this point, this is when the forum in Scotland decide to take it to all the way to the highest court in the land, the UK Supreme Court. And that brings us neatly to last week and the hearings that had taken place in November 2024, and then the ruling that they made last Wednesday on the 16th of April. Now, when Four Women Scotland decide to bring the case to the Supreme Court, the question that they ask of the court to clarify is deceptively simple. What they're essentially asking for is for the court to clarify whether in the Equalities Act of 2010, when it references a person's sex and when it references women and female, are we to understand that as a gender recognition reading of sex, i.e., are we to understand that that includes certificated sex or means certificated sex as well? Or does it only have a biological reading, or does it have both? So they want to clarify, basically, in the Equalities Act, tell us what you meant by man, what you meant by woman, what you meant by sex, what you meant by male, female, and specifically, did it include individuals with gender recognition certificates whereby their certificated sex, ended up being different to their biological sex? And just to clarify, when the UK Supreme Court is, undertaking this hearing, they are not changing legislation. They are not writing anything. They're not enacting anything. It's simply a judicial review. So what they're doing is they're looking at legislation, namely the Equalities Act of 2010 and the Gender Recognition Act of 2004. And they're essentially conducting a forensic analysis of the language and the context to give clarification to the parties involved and also obviously to the wider public about what the legislators meant at the time that they were composing or writing this legislation. So they're not creating anything. They're merely interpreting it and clarifying what Parliament likely meant. I think it's important to note that because I've seen a lot of articles where it implies that the UK government has decided what the definition of man and woman and sex is, or that they've written or changed the law. That's not what took place. It was a judicial review. They were literally just reviewing the legislation as it already existed. Now, in terms of, you know, what both representatives, so the representative or the barrister for the forum in Scotland said, they started out, which, you know, I didn't know that they did this in court. It was very interesting to watch. It was basically, he started out by talking about the historical oppression and discrimination of women. And he goes through, you know, how they were kept out of higher education, how they were kept out of housing, how they were discriminated against during pregnancy and maternity, how they were discriminated against in banking and finance. And he spends like a decent chunk of time on this. Like, it really goes all the way back to like the 1870s. And he brings us all the way to the Sex Discrimination Act of 1975 and how that was like the first time where women were being protected in law on the basis of their sex. He weaves like a really good narrative, like sets the foundation of why women as a class, why biological women as a class have the legal protections that they have. And that is because historically they've been oppressed and discriminated against under patriarchy by men. And so the legislation is there to basically prevent more of that discrimination from taking place. So I thought he was a really rhetorically savvy speaker. He was really impassioned when he was speaking. And I think the way that he set out his case by first talking about the historical context of how the legislation came into being really set him up for success later on. Other stuff that he spoke about was he gave a whole host of reasons, which I won't go into. You can read the judgment, by the way. It's 88 pages and it's worth every read. I'd probably go to like page... like, skip all the introduction stuff, that doesn't really matter, but it gets juicy when they start, like talking about the structure of their arguments. Anyway, he talks about, like, the different reasons why we can only read the Equalities Act as, like, 2010, of why we can only read that as having meant biological sex, given the context that he had just taken us through. But then also how... Lots of different parts are rendered like incoherent or nonsensical or absurd if you take a reading that isn't biological. One of the areas he focuses on is maternity and pregnancy, how because only women obviously can get pregnant, it wouldn't make sense that when Parliament enacted the legislation that it would have included trans women or natal men, because again, that would render the protections absurd. So he goes through the Equalities Act 2010 and finds places where it's just a clear, in his view, clear that it only makes sense if there's a biological reading. But then he also goes through the Gender Recognition Act and he goes through different areas where he shows that it's just incompatible with the Equalities Act of 2010. One of the points that he makes, for example, is that under the Gender Recognition Act, it kind of creates a two-tiered system of rights for trans people as a group. Because what he says is, if individuals with gender recognition certificates are able, through the Gender Recognition Act, to be recognized as their preferred sex legally, and because they're recognized as their preferred sex, it means that they're actually allowed to have access to single spaces. So because you're a trans woman, for example, who's legally a woman, who because they... their certificated sex is now woman through the Gender Recognition Act. Through the Scottish Parliament's interpretation, it would mean that whilst they could enter, for example, sporting competitions that are segregated on sex as women, they could participate as women legally. They could also enter single spaces like changing rooms, like prisons, like hospital wards legally, because again, their sex is legally female. It would mean that trans people, trans women in particular, without the gender recognition certificate, wouldn't have those rights because legally they would still be men under the law. So you have a system where like some trans women have like the access to women-only spaces because they've got this certificate, because they have been certified, or because they've got a certificated sex that says they're female now. But then you've got a whole host of other trans women who don't have access to the same privileges or rights, if you will. So he points out how, like, that's just a contradiction. He also goes through and talks about how the requirements to even get the gender recognition certificate are low. And because they are low, they basically make it incompatible with, like, with allowing trans women into single sex spaces. An example of this is under the Gender Recognition Act, there's like four criteria or so that permits certificated sex women, so women with gender recognition certificates, to be able to be legally recognized as women. And it's basically like they have to be living under their new identity, their new female identity, for 2 years. They have to get a diagnosis of gender dysphoria. They have to have socially transitioned. And that can include things like, you know, changing the name on your documents, like your passport, like your driving license, like your birth certificate, like I mentioned earlier. And then the final requirement is that you have the intention of living in your new identity for the rest of your life or until you die. But what the barrister in the Four Women Scotland says, and his name is O'Neill. I thought he was like really, really good. His name was O'Neill. And what he says is, in practice, though, even though it says all these things in writing on paper, in practice, the only requirement that can be like upheld or enforced or like measured is that the person effectively changes their documents. Because what the board, the panel that decides whether you get a gender recognition certificate, don't want is having to like resort to stereotypical representation of gender. So they don't want to have to interrogate people and ask them, you know, why do you think you're a woman? What makes you a woman? And then have the people have to like dig deep and be like, well, I like lipstick, or I like heels, or I like nurturing, or I like looking after kids. They don't want to have to like reduce people or force people to like dig into stereotypes. So they don't ask those kinds of questions. And so the only thing left on the table really is that the person can evidence that they've transitioned. And practically speaking, O'Neill highlights that all it means is that you just have to show that you've changed your name on your passport, that you have changed your name on your birth certificate, for example, your driver's license. And that's pretty much all it takes. And actually, I was looking at the stats for the issuance of gender recognition certificate, and I think it's something like 95% of all applicants like get the certificate. So it's got an incredibly high rate of just, you know, being accepted or being able to get that certificate. So anyway, he points out how like it's a very low barrier to entry, but that low barrier to entry means that in practice, people can be at different stages of transition, or indeed like non-transition, because there's no requirement in terms of having to undergo gender reassignment surgery. So there's no sex change requirement. There's no requirement to be passing, quote unquote, to be like unsusceptibly trans, so people can't recognize that you're trans. There's no requirement for that. There's no requirement for how you dress or how you behave or how you, there's no requirement for any of those things, because like I said, it would reduce the panel into having to ask questions that are reductive of what it means to be a woman. Now, O'Neill then says it basically means that people who have been certified as being female through this gender recognition certificate can be at different stages in their transition and therefore look as male as any biological man. And that creates real problems when they have access to single spaces, because some single spaces, like the people there are not anticipating that any males are going to be there. And so if the trans woman with a gender certificate who's legally allowed to be in those spaces, according to the Scottish government, enters those spaces, it basically makes it unsafe or uncomfortable for the women in those spaces because they will read them as male. So he talks about like the low barrier to entry creating real problems. So imagine, for example, like a rape crisis center where a trans woman who hasn't gone like deep into the transition, so they might be read male, might not have done very much so far because there's no requirement and there's no like pressure or coercion to necessarily go further than they want to go. Even though that's their individual right to do so, it presents issues for the women in those spaces who are specifically in those spaces to not be subjected or like to not experience the male gaze or to not be around men, it creates problems in running that service for the women in that space, because the trans women who can be there legally, according to the Scottish Parliament, aren't required to make any like big changes, or there's no standard or barrier to entry, essentially. Now, on the other side, on the Scottish Parliament side, that was represented by a woman called Ruth Crawford KC. And she had two arguments that mirrored the arguments that the Scottish Parliament had made when they won their appeal against For Women Scotland. And they essentially say two things. They say, one, the Equalities Act was written or amended, because it used to be the 1975 Act, but then it was amended in 2010. So what they say is that that amendment or that rewriting was done in the full knowledge of the Gender Recognition Act of 2004 that preceded it. And because Parliament obviously knew about the existence of that act, they had enacted that act, the Gender Recognition Act, it means that there's no way that biological sex and certificated sex were not included in the definition of man, woman, sex, female, and male. Because again, they knew they had already just drafted that legislation 6 years earlier. The second thing they say is that the Gender Recognition Act is not incompatible with the Equalities Act 2010, especially where women are concerned, because there are specific carve-outs that allow for the interests and rights of transgender people to be protected, whilst also not infringing on the rights of biological women. Now, taking a step back for a minute and just looking at from a purely like stylistic or like strategic point of view, I thought it was a real missed opportunity that the KC for the Scottish Parliament, so the trans side essentially, it was a missed opportunity because they didn't have the same grounding in their case of context. So whereas O'Neill started out by going through the historical oppression of women and why that like necessitated their legal protection as exemplified in the 1975 Sex Discrimination Act and then the 2010 Equalities Act, and contrasting that with like how the Gender Recognition Act undermined that long and hard fought for like battle for protection against discrimination and oppression. The side of the Scottish Parliament didn't do that. There was no appeal to the marginalization of trans people. There's no appeal to the violence, for empathy for the violence that they face or the harassment that they face, which I'll talk about later on. There was no emotional appeal. There's no grounding in the historical context of like the trans movement. There was no stats given about why it is they also need protection against male violence. So I thought that was like, I think like strategically thinking, I thought, I don't know, I would have been annoyed on the trans side that it was so lackluster in the creating a bigger story or grounding the legal arguments within the wider context and the wider story of the trans experience or the trans movement's experience. So that's the first thing. The second thing was that whereas O'Neill spoke at length for a long time, I think in total he probably spoke for maybe 4.5 hours. Most of the time he got a couple of clarifying questions from the judges, but it was very much just that, like clarifying questions. Whereas when the solicitor for the Scottish Parliament was speaking, it was a lot of questions, especially in the second session. Like the second day that she was speaking, that she was presenting her case with support from her juniors and with support from the intervener on her side. So the the Equalities and Human Rights Commission, actually. She got a lot of questions that felt like it was nonstop. It was like at one point she got like 5, 6, 7 questions back to back. And you could tell she was very calm and collected and measured throughout most of it. But during the inquisition from the judges, and that's kind of like what it felt like, you could tell like she was very much on defense. Like she was very much like fielding off all these difficult questions. And I felt empathy for her in that perspective, because a lot of the time she'll be reduced to saying like, you know, I'm not going to say any more on that, or I accept what you're saying and let's just leave it at that, let's move on. Or she would say a lot of let me sort of find that information and get back to you later. But it felt very much like she probably already knew these questions were coming, and she probably didn't have a good answer, because some of the answers are very, very, some of the questions are very difficult. And it was the best thing she could do in the moment to sort of diffuse from the growing feeling that, like, the case was sinking on their side, essentially. Now, beyond sort of like those stylistic or strategic sort of comments, there was like a number of things in their case that I think let them down, or very difficult challenges, shall we say, for them to overcome. The first is like what I said earlier, was that the gender recognition certificate allows all trans people with it to be legally recognized as their preferred or chosen gender. But other people who identify as trans but are not legally trans, like, don't have access to the same privileges. So the whole point of like group-based protections or group-based rights is that the whole group is supposed to benefit. So now you've created a system in which there's a two-tiered system of transness, one that gets legal protection and legal recognition and legal rights, and then the other that doesn't. That was the first issue that they really couldn't resolve. The second thing was that they weren't really able to address how the privacy, dignity, and safety of women can be preserved if biological men can be admitted, especially in the context of what O'Neill had said, whereby the entry is like the barrier to entry is very low. Like, there's no requirement for you to have a trans, to have like a gender reassignment surgery. There's no requirement for you to be passing. There's no requirement for you to present in a particular way. There's no reassignment for psychological treatment to like navigate being a woman easier. There's no requirement for any of those things. So, you know, she kept getting a lot of these questions, and it was clear that they hadn't really found a solution to that. The other thing was that they weren't really able to distinguish between what makes a trans woman with a gender recognition certificate a woman, but a trans woman without a gender recognition certificate a man. So given that there's basically a two-tiered system where people who have the certificate are legally female, but the people without the certificate are still legally men, they can be at the exact same point of their transition. They can look very similar. They could be like still be very male presenting because they're early in their process, or they might not want to go any further than they've already gone. But somehow one has legal recognition and protection and rights and access to female spaces, but the other doesn't. And so a thing that kept coming up quietly at first, but then like more like louder or more like obvious as time went by, was sort of like, what is the line that differentiates these two groups? And is that line of differentiation enough of a difference for them to be allowed into female spaces? Now, the final thing I'll say about like the Crawford side or the Scottish Parliament side was, at some point Crawford and her juniors, more so Crawford actually, but also actually their intervener on their side, so the group that advanced their case or spoke on their behalf, was the Equality and Human Rights Commission, as I mentioned. And both him, the guy who represented the Equality and Human Rights Commission, and Crawford, who represented the Scottish Parliament, halfway through stopped saying trans women and just started saying men. Like, I think it's because she was tired, or they were tired, because, you know, the court cases did go on for a long time. But at some point I noticed, I was like, well, first of all, I would be furious as a trans woman or a trans person that the representative of my side, like halfway through their hearings, has stopped referring to me as a trans woman or woman and has just said man. Not even, at some points, she wasn't, or they weren't even saying like men who identify as women, they were just saying like men. So it shows you the degree to which there isn't buy-in psychologically or emotionally or ideologically into what they're defending. And I would suspect, if I was a person who's prone to suspicion, that they were fighting a case that they didn't believe in. And it really showed in their lackluster performance. One thing I didn't mention on their side, on the Scottish Parliament side, in the representative, was that Miss Crawford, you know, the KC, spoke for like a couple of hours, but then her junior took over and covered a different segment. And when her junior came up, it was so like, It was so dull, so dry. All she did was like quote like 1,000 different statutes and substatutes and references. But she didn't actually make any arguments. She didn't say, these are the 5 reasons I'm going to give why the Gender Recognition Act is compatible with the Equalities Act 2010. And then she goes through that, and then she uses those statutes as references to back up what she's saying. She didn't do that. She basically just like read like act after act after act. It was tedious. It was dull. And it also, to me, just felt like there was no psychological or ideological buy-in into what they were representing. And as the hearing wore on, and Crawford, the Scottish Parliament side, kept referring to like trans women as men, like not even like trans women who identify, not even men who identify as women, but just like men. I thought, this explains your poor behavior. Like, they already had a very difficult case anyway, because there's so many different challenges that they honestly kind of felt insurmountable anyway. But on top of that, like, it felt like they were downtrodden anyway. It felt like they were downtrodden even before they went into the hearing. And it also showed, as time went on, by their references to like trans women in particular as men, and also at times like trans men as women, that they didn't believe what they were saying, essentially. Now, after the 9 hours of hearings or so, the court adjourned for a few months, and they came back with a unanimous decision. And that decision was that after having considered the interveners, so the interveners are basically like different groups that speak on behalf of both sides to advance their cases. And on the case of on the side of the 4 Women Scotland, they had Sex Matters, the institution that I mentioned earlier. Actually, no, I didn't mention them earlier. Sex Matters basically advances the rights of women, girls, and children. LGB Alliance is an organization or charity that advances the interests of lesbian, gay, and bisexual people. And then Scottish Lesbians and the Lesbian Project advance the interests of lesbians. And they all argued for biological sex being the definition that we should base the Equalities Act on, because they said that there is widespread ramifications for same-sex attracted people, because it essentially means that they do not have the right of freedom of association, because they now have to include members of the opposite sex, but their sexual orientation by definition means that they're attracted to the people of the same sex, not people of the same gender, not to certificates, as they said, not to pieces of paper, but to like bodies. And the lesbian like segment in particular talked a lot about like the invisibility of lesbians in general, and how basically their identities as lesbian women in general within the context of the LGBT movement are always underrepresented. They're always sort of put to the back. And on top of that, there's a long history of like men essentially invading the sexual spaces of lesbians because they sort of don't see it as a legitimate thing, or they see it as some kind of kink, or they see they have a sense of entitlement to female bodies, and that extends to lesbians who are exclusively attracted to women, as the definition of lesbian must mean. Anyway, basically, most of their arguments revolved around that, about the freedom of association and the right to be same-sex attracted, and that means a very specific thing, and that including or being forced to include members of the opposite sex essentially means the erasure of same-sex attracted people. Now, although the court had an 88-page judgment, like written judgment, that details exactly the evidence that they considered, the argumentation presented by both sides, some of the questions that they had teased out from both sides, and then the forensic analysis of the text of the legislation and the context around the legislation, and they looked also at the preceding legislation that had been amended. So, for example, they looked at the Sex Discrimination Act that went on to become the Equalities Act of 2010. And they undertook all that work to basically contextualize what Parliament might have meant or likely meant. And then also what the implications would be if they considered that interpretation as being certificated sex or biological sex, and whether that had any incompatibilities within the Equalities Act, and whether that had any incompatibilities with other legislation, namely the Gender Recognition Act of 2004 in this case. And as I said, the ruling was unanimous, and the conclusion was that Parliament could only have meant biological sex given the context and given other areas where they specifically like talk about things that only affect women. So, for example, looking at the pregnancy protection and maternity protection, if they had meant certificated sex, they would have had to explicitly clarify that that was the case, but it's unlikely given the way in which the text is written. Now, immediately, maybe not immediately, but like a few days after the court gave its judgment, that the Equality and Human Rights Commission basically put out interim guidance based on the ruling and what they have said, which is basically an echo of what the judge read out during the spoken summary of the judgment. They said that given this interpretation of sex meaning biological sex, it means that a woman is a biological woman or girl, so a person born female. And when the act references a man, it means a biological man or boy, so a person born male. And they say that if somebody identifies as trans, they do not change sex for the purposes of the act, even if they have a gender recognition certificate, which is like a major departure, because in the last few years, certificated sex basically meant that you were legally that sex. So what they say is now a trans woman is a biological man, a trans man is a biological woman. And this judgment, of course, is going to have like an impact on lots of organizations. It's going to affect how workplaces like operate and the kinds of facilities that they have to provide, services that are open to the public, such as hospitals, shops, restaurants, leisure facilities, refuges, counseling services. It's going to have an impact on sporting bodies. And actually, I already saw that, I think it was Ultimate Pool already changed its guidance around inclusion of trans women, because I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago where the finale for the women's ultimate pool, both contestants were trans women. So there was kind of a bit of a outcry about that. So some sporting bodies have already come out and echoed that and said that they're revising their inclusion of trans women or men who identify as women in the participation of sex-segregated sports. And then other areas where it's going to have an impact is in schools. So schools, they've clarified that they have to have separate toilets for boys and girls over the age of 11, I think it is. And then they also have to have different spaces or segregated spaces for changing rooms as well. And then as far as associations or clubs, they've also said that they have that where membership is based on sex. So for example, think of like a gay men organization or a lesbian organization or a woman's organization, then they have to make sure that that is only open to that biological sex. Otherwise, they might be acting unlawfully. Now, I have to say for me personally, and probably for a lot of people, this case highlighted a lot of things. One of the things that it highlighted was that, you know, many companies and organizations, it seems, have been breaking the law by admitting trans people into single spaces where they don't have like a gender recognition certificate, because the gender recognition certificate basically like overrides your biological reality and legally recognizes you as your preferred sex. So you're a trans man and you're biologically a woman, obviously, but because of the gender recognition certificate, you are legally in the eyes of the law a man. And therefore, like, if organizations that have single spaces admit you, they're technically not breaking the law, or at least before this reading, weren't breaking the law, because legally you have been recognized as that your preferred sex. You're a trans man, so you've been legally recognized as a man. Similarly, with women, trans women with gender recognition certificates, they have been made through the eyes of the law legally women. And so for organizations that provide services based on single sex, or spaces based on single sex, they weren't breaking the law, because that trans woman was legally, or in the eyes of the law, a woman for all intents and purposes, again, before the judgment from the Supreme Court. However, what was happening was that all trans people were being admitted to single spaces, which means that there was a large segment that weren't legally their preferred sex. They were under, in the eyes of the law, and like not only biologically their sex, but also legally that sex, or the sex that shouldn't have been allowed to gain access to those spaces. So, you know, interesting to see if people will bring cases against those organizations, especially in the context of like some of the public discourse and fallout from like women in particular essentially resigning from their jobs because they've challenged their employers for admitting like people who are biologically the opposite sex into single sex spaces. You know, it's in, I'd be interested to see if any cases are brought against those employers. And maybe legally there's an answer why either that can or can't happen. Let me know if you know. One of the things I did look into as part of my investigation of this, or my research in this, was I wanted to understand to what degree organizations were breaking the law. And when I looked at the numbers of the number of people who have gender recognition certificates, it was actually a lot lower than I anticipated. So going on to the Office of National Statistics, they basically estimate how many people, like how many trans people there are and how many people have gender recognition certificates. And through that, roughly about 7.4% of the trans population have gender recognition certificates. So in other words, like 92.6% of the population of trans people are trans. They identify as the opposite sex and their biological sex, but they legally under the law are still biologically their sex. And so given that these places were admitting 100% of trans people into single sex spaces, it potentially means that there's a lot of people who might have a case against their service providers or various organizations for that breach in legislation, essentially. Another thing I thought about was how some of the pending cases we have surrounding this issue, as I said, mostly around like women who are in like their workplaces and they're changing, and there's like trans women there, and they protest to that, and their employers basically like take a position against them and they are forced to resign. There's a few of these cases. There's a couple to do with the NHS that are still pending. And what this judgment essentially means, or effectively means, is that they've won those cases. The women have won those cases because the reason why those organizations were taking a position against them was that there was an assumption that trans women, with or without a gender recognition certificate, like could be included in single spaces, because under the Gender Recognition Act, they were legally those women. But one of the quirks about the Gender Recognition Act is that employers and organizations and service providers are not allowed to ask for a gender recognition certificate. And if they do, it's a breach of law. They're breaking the law, essentially. So it's sort of like the only thing that employers could do in that context was that they just had to admit all of them, because if they can't ask to see the certificate because they're breaking the law, unless it's for like medical purposes, I think it is. I think that's the carve out, or there's a couple of carve outs, but the carve outs don't apply to 99% of the of employers and organizations and service providers. Basically, they're in a position where they break the law, they ask for the certificate to verify that the person is legally that sex. They just chose the safer route, or the route that is likely to result in less litigation against them. And that was the route of basically just admitting all trans people. So the pending cases, essentially, the women have won. Another thing I noticed throughout this sort of period and watching like lots of interviews was there's a lot of like alliances of convenience. You saw a lot of people who typically you wouldn't see them together because they were so ideologically opposed. Like you saw, for example, like right-wing outlets. And right-wing, I don't mean conservative, as I've said in previous episodes. Like, I don't think that just because you're conservative, it means you're right-wing necessarily. But what I did see was a lot of like right-wing, genuinely right-wing outlets suddenly being like concerned about the interests and rights of lesbian women. Like, they're talking to lesbian women, they were sympathetic to their cause, they were championing their rights. And it's like, in any other day of the week, like, they would obviously not be speaking about those groups positively. So you saw right-wing supporting like lesbians and gay men and being concerned about the issues of gay men and lesbian women. Another thing was that you saw men on the left and right who otherwise have like nothing to say about rape culture. They've got nothing to say about violence against women. They've got nothing to say about the unequal division of power and capital along sex to the disadvantage of women, have a lot to say about the issue. You know, like, they're silent on all these other areas where they are conveniently like the beneficiaries, where they are the beneficiaries. But somehow, like, in this particular cause, like, they were like so vehemently in support of trans women's rights specifically. And I say trans women specifically because they never really talk about trans men. So it was sort of like seeing these men suddenly be political activists where this issue is concerned, but not being activists in any other issues that affects not only like women, but also like trans women. Another thing that I saw was how there was a lot of people that I would describe as being men's rights activists. And I use this term sort of semi, like, as an insult, in that my view is that often, especially those on YouTube and those who are like on social media, they're never concerned about the actual things that make life difficult for men. They don't focus on those issues. They don't focus on like mental health issues, for example. They don't focus on social isolation of men that's caused by the patriarchy and caused by the way that men are socialized in society by other men and also by women. They don't focus on any of those things. They tend to focus mostly on how women are the oppressors somehow. Like, they'll cite things to do with like how the court system always like favors women, even though most of the time men never apply for full custody. Or they'll talk about how like women have all these advantages, like not having to go to war. Never mind the fact that 99.99% of all conflicts are started by men. Or they'll talk about all kinds. They're always focused on how women are the oppressors. Anyway, the point is that in this discussion, like, you would think that they wouldn't necessarily be involved because last time I checked, they're not particularly interested or invested or committed to the interest of trans women either, or trans men either. But somehow, like, they kind of were like highly visible and like out and proud supporting trans women in this discussion, or in this discourse, or in this like conflict, if you will. And part of me can't help but feel that it's because it's another opportunity for them to sort of stick it to women. And by that I mean, I don't believe that they are supportive of trans people or trans women or trans men. I don't think that they would be marching like on a regular basis or donate any money or take literally any other positive action. I think they're just, it's a marriage of convenience in that they saw that women were spearheading the campaign to basically get clarification from the court about what the legislation meant when it referenced like sex and the definition of woman and man. And because they saw women being at the forefront of this like challenge, you know, for the Supreme Court, they basically had to put themselves in opposition. And who was in opposition was basically the trans movement, and so they just aligned themselves with them, not because they like ideologically support them necessarily, but because, again, their primary focus is to be in opposition to women. Now, I think I'm going to wrap it up there for this week. I had a lot more to say. I think I'll do a follow-up episode next week because I wanted to go through some of the argumentation that was made primarily by the trans side, which I felt kind of resulted in not only the public discourse around the subject sort of turning so like ugly, I will say, but also like how some of these arguments manifested in the hearing, just to give some rebuttal to those. So I'll try and do a follow-up episode next week. If I don't do it next week, I'll definitely do one in the future, but I'll end it there for this week. Again, as always, thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed the episode and were able to listen to the very end. If you did like the episode, I would really appreciate it if you left me a review wherever you get your podcast from. And I will definitely catch you next Monday.